You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 23rd, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the Gowanus, the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nikki Usher, author of News for the Rich, White and Blue. Meanwhile, the FDA has granted full approval to the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine, which will, of course, finally shut up the anti-vax crowd, right? But bad news for them, this opens the door for more vaccine mandates. Whoops. Hurricane Henri hit the Northeast hard over the weekend after flash flooding killed at least 22 people in Tennessee. Pearson Cinema has doubled down after voting yes on the budget resolution for the $3.5 trillion infrastructure package. She's insisting that she'll vote no on that very package unless it's cut down to meet her arbitrary threshold. And in the House, a group of moderates continues its standoff with Pelosi and progressives, threatening to sink the reconciliation package entirely. But in a twist, the DCCC is threatening to withhold funding if the centrists continue down this road, a bit of a taste of their own medicine. In Afghanistan, mayhem continues. Reports indicate at least 20 people have died in and around the Kabul airport in the last week, some killed by the chaos, some by U.S. forces, many by the Taliban. In northern Afghanistan, though, opposition groups have retaken three districts from the Taliban. And lastly, back in the U.S., hundreds of Nabisco workers are on strike at three different plants as management has threatened to cut benefits despite recording billions in profits. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you had a great weekend. I hope you stayed safe. If you're in the Northeast, or if you're in Tennessee, or if you're in any of the regions affected by Hurricane Henri, I think I got to say it in the French because it's got an I at the end of it, but I don't speak French, so you guys got to suffer through that. But I hope all is well on your end, and with COVID, I hope everyone's staying safe as well. The numbers still remain quite high with the Delta variant. It feels like we're hitting some sort of peak or plateau. There's no way to know quite yet, but one can only hope. Because especially now that the FDA has decided to give the Pfizer vaccine full authorization, I was told that that's all these anti-vaxxers needed. And then they're going to be ready to just get the jab in line the next day. I don't know. Forgive my skepticism in that area. Because let's turn to Alabama. Former President Donald Trump held a maskless rally in Alabama on Saturday. And Alabama has been in the news a lot recently for running out of ICU beds as Delta runs rampant, tragically, over the state, one of the least vaccinated states in the country. However, in a twist, the man Donald Trump decided to urge his audience to get vaccinated, and it didn't go that well for him, especially because he could breathe or fart and the whole crowd would cheer normally. But it seems like he's created a monster and he can't control it anymore.
3 days, less than 9 months, and it's great. And you know what? I believe totally in your freedoms. I do. Bree, you got to do what you have to do. But I recommend take the vaccines. I did it. It's good. Take the vaccines. But you got, no, that's okay. That's all right. You got your freedoms. But I happen to take the vaccine. If it doesn't work, you'll be the first to know. Okay? I'll call up Alabama and say, hey, you know what? But it is working. But you do have your freedoms. You have to maintain that. You have to maintain that. And you got to get your kids back to school.
Right. So he walked it back a bit there, right? You hear those boos.
He walked it back like four times. He did. If you just count the butts in that sentence, like, you gotta get your freedoms, but I took it. But right. Gotta get your freedoms. That is, I think.
But you gotta get the kids back to school.
The dictionary definition of mixed messaging.
Well, yeah, certainly. He is a crowd surfer. He tries to walk back it and make the crowd laugh, but there was some tepid kind of frustration or unsuredness that you could feel in the crowd. But as I say, when you create a monster, don't be surprised when you can't control the monster. And even Trump, who tried to pocket COVID denial as a part of a political strategy when he was leaving office, not telling anybody that he'd been vaccinated, and it came out a few months later, not revealing his vaccination status, even he can't control it. Because I think it's an indication of a few things, but one of the main takeaways for me is the man is not in control of the narrative anymore. He's not visible in the way that he once was, and part of that has to do with the fact that he is no longer on social media sites, major ones, and he's having difficulty communicating publicly, and news organizations have made decisions about not just airing every word that he says, which was a huge part of his victory in 2016, just not showing Bernie Sanders rallies at all, and waiting with bated breath at Trump's empty podium, for example. But these diehards, yeah, they'll cling to everything he says, 100%, the MAGA crowd.
Well, yeah, you can finish your point
but,
there.
But the, many of them are right now just moving on to news sources or new politicians or Marjorie Taylor Greene or whoever to satiate their impulses in this area.
Yeah, I mean, this is the difference between the GOP and the Democrats. The Democrats like to control and sort of finely guide the enthusiasms of their base, whereas the GOP will take whatever enthusiasms they can get where they can get them, because their main project is pretty unappealing, like basically just lower tax cuts for the wealthy. And the thing is, like, Trump could tell them, look, just get the vaccine, you idiots, right? And, like, people would boo, but eventually that would have a big effect. But they don't want to do that because ultimately this is too valuable for them electorally.
Exactly. And a good reminder to everybody that in the fall, Trump was getting his base all riled up about the vaccine not being approved fast enough. And this is very much in keeping, Matt and I were talking about this before the show, with a long conservative undercurrent about approval of, say, experimental drugs. They're saying, you need to let the free market decide, and you need to open these up to capitalism so that these treatments can't be behind some government wall of approval.
Yeah, this is a common moral blackmail take you'll hear from the right, when particularly the Democrats are in power, that your red tape is stopping X cure from getting to patients. You're basically killing those people.
Right. And now, full FDA approval coming down the pike from the FDA. And so there should be no excuses anymore. But as we'll get to later in the program, that's not the case. This is just the latest iteration of shifting of the goalposts. But I would imagine Trump going forward, if he still wants to run, who knows if that's the case anymore. I would imagine he steers away from some of this vaccine denial, but how can you?
Again, like, they need to, like, try to harvest as many of those people they can while still, you know, getting people vaccinated at the rate where they can open up businesses and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's pretty gross. I mean, I know COVID's rising in North Dakota. North Dakota is one of the worst as far as getting vaccinated. And, you know, I know weddings happening in a few weeks, and it's, you know, ugly to see. But ultimately, I think you just need to mandate this stuff. And that's ultimately the good news about the CDC thing, is it will allow mandates to be a lot easier. And they just need to be done. And if there's protests and stuff, people can protest. And if they choose to get onto the streets to protest against a vaccine that can stop them from being a disease vector, as opposed to, like, say, police brutality and violence, you know, that's on them. They can get out and protest.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Dr. Nikki Usher, if we have her. But We're going to throw to Sam. He's got some ads for you from the past.
Hey, folks. Folks are always looking for an opportunity to help others out. And sometimes people do that at the end of the year. Sometimes they do it quarterly. Sometimes they just do it randomly. And for me, I have found that the best place for me to find charities that I may not be aware of and to assess the impact they're going to have is via givewell.org. They've been around since 2010. They have helped over 50,000 donors find places where their donations can save or improve lives the most. GiveWell basically recommends a bunch of different charities. They have a very rigorous and academic and independent studies of the cost effectiveness of all of their programs. Giving to the right charity can be tricky. You don't want your place, your money to go to fly-by nights or to places that really don't have a big impact. GiveWell is a one-stop place to determine, you know, how they're spending their money, how effective it is, what the ratios are, et cetera, et cetera. GiveWell dedicates over 20,000 hours a year to researching charitable organizations. They handpick a few of the most high-impact, evidence-based charities. Like I say, 50,000 donors have given almost $750 million. These donations will save over 75,000 lives and improve the lives of millions more. And here's the best part. GiveWell is free. It's totally free. And GiveWell doesn't take a cut of your donation. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charities that you choose. Plus, they publish all of their research online at their site totally for free. For me, I discovered GiveDirectly. I don't think it's related to GiveWell. And, you know, all the research that we saw over the course of COVID, I mean, I think I had seen studies to this in the past, like the best way to help people, the most efficient use of your money is you give the money to them directly. And that's what GiveDirectly does. There's other charities on there that are great too, but this one really struck me. I had no idea it was out there. When I found it, it has become one of my go-to charities. GiveDirectly. You can find that at givewell.org. And if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $1,000 before the end of August. Or as long, of course, as matching funds last. To claim your match, go to givewell.org and pick podcast and the Majority Report at checkout. Make sure that they know that you heard about GiveWell from the Majority Report to get your donation matched. It's going to run out at the end of August. So if you want to double your impact, now is the time to do it. Givewell.org. Also, we're living in an era where folks have a lot of on-demand needs and desires. One click. That's what I like to do. If I want something, I like one click. Well, if you're a business out there, understand what I have just articulated is what your customers want. Customers have grown to expect a simpler way of doing business no matter what your product is. That's why more than 90,000 local businesses of all sizes have turned to Podium. Doesn't matter whether you have one location or 1,000 locations, Podium can help you stay ahead. Podium makes doing business as easy as sending a text. All of your employees can text from a single inbox, offering a smoother experience for all your customers. Doesn't matter whether you're answering questions, whether you're collecting reviews, scheduling appointments and deliveries, or dealing with payment collection. All you have to do is just send a text. Car dealerships are selling more cars by offering text messaging. One dealer just sold a $50,000 truck in 4 text messages. Retailers are increasing revenue by allowing customers to shop via text message. Many people still want to shop from home. Jeweler just sold a $5,000 ring with a few text messages and even coordinated curbside pickup with Podium. I can tell you that in dealing with our IT guy from our router situation, I would love it if they had a simpler system rather than the weird, bizarre Byzantine system that they've got me hooked into. Check it out, folks. Today's customers expect on-demand everything from even from local businesses. Stay ahead of the competition with Podium. They have free plans for growing businesses, plus all the power growing businesses need to scale. Get started free today at podium.com/majority. That's podium.com/majority. Check it out. All of our links are in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Now back to Emma.
Well, folks, the Emma Jordy report is not above our guests not being able to, us not being able to get a hold of our guests. Unfortunately, you know, on Friday we had technical difficulties. Not going as smoothly as I thought, the takeover. I guess it's a little bit harder than one would imagine to.
Yeah, no, this isn't reflecting well on new Brendan Bradley, Emma's takeover, or Matt as the steady hand that's been here for a whole long time.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, unfortunately, we can't get a hold of Nikki, but I was looking forward to the interview. Maybe she'll be able to join us, but for now, we're going to talk a little bit more about the news, myself and Matt, with Bradley's new Brendan steady hand behind the scenes. So, let's actually, since we were talking a little bit about the vaccine before, I want to talk about or show a clip of Fox News' response this morning. So this morning, Fox News responded to the news that the Pfizer vaccine is going to be getting full approval by the FDA. And this is a clear example of how these goalposts are going to be shifted no matter what the outcome is, by Fox News. And just so you understand the ridiculousness of this, this is Dana Perino. This is considered to be one of the news people, right? Is that fair to categorize her as such?
Yeah, I mean, my memory is that she was like a Bush spokesperson.
Yes.
But yeah, she's, you know, has the patent of been around for two decades. So,
right. So essentially, though, this is Dana Perino, considered to be on the right, but fine with the establishment, not a crazy loon. This isn't Mike Lindell here, outflanking Trump on COVID denial, honestly, because we just played the clip of Trump encouraging people to get the vaccine. They're moving.
Look, I got to be responsible, but you have to be free. So let's just find a balance, okay?
Right. Right. And here is how Fox responded to the news about the full approval this morning.
News alert for you now. The FDA just giving full approval to Pfizer's COVID vaccine. It's the first vaccine to get that full approval, and in record time, too. That has critics asking if the process was rushed. Was it? Well,
was it? So another thing that they often do is hide behind critics are saying this, when really it's just this is the narrative that we want to push for our particular audience. We knew this was going to happen. The full approval thing was just, in terms of the anti-vaxxers' own logic, faulty in and of itself, because it's all, how can we trust the government? How can we trust the for-profit big pharma that's trying to push this vaccine on us?
It was just an anomaly, right? Like, they could point to, and one right. That once it was solved, they weren't going to look at as if, oh, well, I guess that's fixed. I can change my mind about the vaccines now.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so this is going to be what they run with now that it has its full approval. Oh, the full approval was too swift. The full approval happened in a way that I don't necessarily trust. When what the entire thing boils down to is a mistrust of science and institutions and the fact that a Democrat is in control of the executive branch at this current moment. And it also boils down to, for a lot of evangelical Christians, like this religious pure body thing and trusting in a higher power. So there's a lot of stuff that they're playing into right now, but it's particularly unconscionable when you have the news daytime programming of Fox News more immorally approaching a vaccine conversation than even Trump is at in his current like position. Because Trump's like, I don't know, the jab, get the shot. I got the shot. I want everybody to go back to normal life. I mean, that's, or I want you to go back to normal life. And I think a lot of Republican powers that be, I'd imagine he's still talking to people. We're seeing this shift there too, where they're worried about this anti-vaxxer push alienating the suburban women, suburbanites throughout the country, people who they still need to court for them to have any electoral success, even though, of course, there might be some backlash given that Biden's approval rating is falling at the current moment.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced that they're playing this right electorally. I mean, it's pretty outrageous to say that they're playing a pandemic correctly or not. Like, I think the problem they have is Republicans always appeal to the people that are unaffected by the brutal reality of the systems we have set up. And instead, you just drive them to the polls with fear about stuff. But the problem is, when the fear is something that they're saying you won't be affected by. And it turns out that all these states that thought, okay, we're going to be done with it, DeSantis made another gamble that he'd just be able to like sort of bluff his way through this and it'd go away on its own and end up killing a whole bunch of people, compared to, say, New York, which saw a rise in cases too, but not a similar rise in deaths, at least not so far. And that's people know the people who died. Fundamentally, we lost over 500,000 people in this country, and it's crazy to me that we still have this amount of resistance to it. But I think this is the wrong Republican Party.
The data is in, right? Like, we've never had such a massive data set of hundreds of millions of people getting the vaccine, and we've had millions and tens of millions of people who've gotten COVID, and we see what the effects of one are and what the effects of the other are. We don't need, I don't even think, the FDA to tell us that. That's why the emergency use happened. And then we had a big experiment, basically, and it played out quite obviously. But when you've trained an entire population to look for alternative answers to dominant narratives and be inherently mistrustful of what a consensus of experts say, they're going to find wrinkles in even the largest of experiments and data sets and the most conclusive outcomes of those things. So conspiratorial thinking being stoked, of course it has its ramifications, and that's clear in terms of just like pure death total.
Yeah, we should also say Mississippi officials warn against using livestock ivermectin to prevent COVID-19 after rise in poison control calls. So that's what another part of this is, to sell Miro cures. First was hydroxychloroquine and now ivermectin.
Is in ivermectin? Is it like a dewormer?
Yeah, it's like some sort of a parasite control thing.
So you're cool with taking a dewormer? But not a shot.
Off-label use, yeah.
Yeah. I don't understand where that line is drawn. I guess ivermectin's been around for many decades. Not for this particular use, for this novel coronavirus.
And there's ultimately the cynical way, too, that they play on the, like, sort of pharma skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
As in, like, you know, they don't want you to take this horse dewormer, drug, because it'll cost them a whole bunch of money. It's like,
it's downstream from the elite critique that Tucker Carlson engages
exactly
in.
Right. It's basically just like the socialism of fools sorts of like, take as much as you need, but don't implicate capitalism wholly, whatever you do.
Yeah. And unfortunately, when you have conspiracy theories of that kind, the ones that are most pernicious are the ones that have kernels of truth and skepticism to them. Like, for example, Bush did 9/11. We should be skeptical of the Bush administration and
particularly like putting Henry Kissinger on the investigation team.
Yeah, we should be skeptical of the CIA and the Pentagon and the Bush administration's motives, because they were clearly to just start a war with Iraq by any means possible. But that doesn't mean that Bush did 9/11, right? Like, but the reason maybe people believe in that a little bit more, or it's faded a bit, or at the time it was more widespread, was because of that very kernel of truth there. And here, yeah, Big Pharma is largely an evil enterprise that milks people for profit, but it's really just a function of capitalism, honestly, when you commodify health care. But the skepticism towards big pharma in this country is warranted. We've essentially milked people of their money in order to pay for their health care, and people are resentful of these mega corporations that charge them $400 for necessary diabetes treatment or whatever the case may be. So that is something that is being very, very cynically weaponized by people who are in the pocket of those very industries, politicians in the pocket of these very industries. And like, Fox News has no problem with big pharma. Are you kidding me? It's just the shadow of it that they want to use.
Yeah, if you want to stick it to big pharma, you force them to release their patents to the world about these new high-tech vaccines instead of recommending another one of their products people go out and find. Right? Like that's what I think part of this is about.
That's why they don't want you to know about it. That's why we're asking you to buy something that puts money directly in their pockets.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, like, I think big pharma, if we want to distrust them for a moment, they have this new technology that has been juiced by government funding and the necessity of a pandemic, and they want to keep control of it. So that's what we need to open those patents to the world. Mm-hmm. And so you want to stick it to pharma, you want a pharma critique, that's where it should be, not take their, you know, raid your veterinary's cabinet.
The issue with that, too, is because they're not interested in that. They're not interested in that kind of larger scale critique. They want to still engage with capitalism in the same ways that that they always have, but just particularly cling on to this cultural critique. It looks like we actually have Nikki, so let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. All right. I would like to welcome to the show Nikki Usher. She is the author of News for the Rich, White and Blue. Nikki, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So we're coming off, in my opinion, a really clear and obvious display of the media bubble that you described, this elite media consensus in the wake of the Afghanistan withdrawal is a great example of it. I guess let's start there. What were your thoughts, given the fact that you have so much experience in this field, at what you saw in terms of comparatively the public's response, which I think largely is let's get out of Afghanistan, to the entire media losing their minds?
So I think there is like a really interesting inroad to your question, which is the way that the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal put forward their own like public diplomacy effort to rescue anybody that was associated with helping the papers and their families. I think that that is like a really good illustration of kind of on one level, like how the news media doesn't see itself as like everybody else. And that like, you know, it is very rare for those three papers to collaborate on anything. In fact, I don't remember the last time they've co-written a letter like that. Maybe in response to some of the Trump stuff, there was sort of more of an implicit agreement about how to handle the president. But this is like an explicit ask of the Biden administration. And then these papers went ahead on their own and like positioned, and the New York Times had their foreign correspondent, also a Marine, and like they positioned him at the airport to like run logistics to get their people out. And I think that that's like a really, to me, you know, yes, there is the media losing their mind and it's an investment in a story. And yes, there is the differing public response, but sometimes these single actions and single moments really highlight where the power is. And I think that that's a really clear example of like whose lives matter, who has the ability to demand special treatment. And like, just kind of like a highlighting of like, the press is the most important thing. Right? So I didn't really quite totally answer your question, but I think that that speaks to it almost more, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a great kind of conduit into one of the opening stories in your book about this like lavish DC celebration with the likes of Marty Baron and Bob Woodward. And then there's so much lobster, lots and lots of lobster consumed. And kind of just how that was instructive for the way that you were trying to analyze some of the way that these elite media institutions and media in general is structured in this country. So just talk about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what was that party, right? So the Washington Post moved into a new building after Bezos bought it and took about like a year or so. But when you get a new building, you have a big party, and it was a chance to like bring all the DC glitterati together. So these are names that you and I would recognize, but maybe like the ordinary person wouldn't. And it was like this week long celebration. So the like one night that I went, it was to inaugurate the Page One room as like the Ben Bradley story room. And what struck me was like how detail oriented the display was. So like the scotch was in the proper highball glass, and the wine was in like their wine glass, and the champagne was in a champagne flute. And like, just who thinks about stemware like that? Do you know what I mean? I feel like, and it just
rich. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe. Right. Like, and then the next day there were like these monogrammed Washington Post napkins and guava juice, which really kind of hit me over the head, and like three types of water. And it's like, so sometimes like these material things even say more than anything else. But it's also like, who other than the Post would get the Secretary of State to like welcome their building, right? And say like, congratulations. And so it just, it was like, it felt so closed off to the reality of A, what was happening at other newspapers and media outlets across the country. But B, just being physically situated there in Washington, right, across the street from the new Post building is where probably like the largest concentration of homeless people really are in downtown DC. And it's like, we're here having guava juice, and, you know, there are all these like really truly poor people outside, and you can't even really see them from the windows, you know? And it kind of just that sense of detachment, especially in the wake of the Trump administration. It wasn't just about the news media's detachment. It was about like how detached they were from like the rest of the American experience.
So let's talk about then the kind of homogeneity of newsrooms. They tend to be rich, cosmopolitan, also geographically homogeneous, which I thought was a really interesting, you know, part of your book, and white. And there are ramifications for that dynamic. And also the fact that journalism is not, when you're starting out, it's essentially really difficult to make ends meet if you're coming at it from a background that isn't somebody who has money already in the bank. So talk about all of these factors that craft modern newsrooms, especially at some of these elite institutions that have so much sway over the way people in power see things and how the conversation goes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that like when we talk about what's going on in journalism in America and like the decline of trust in news and all of that, and it's often phrased from like a supply side or a demand side problem. Like people don't want this stuff, or people are reading misinformation, or whatever, you know, the current, you know, people don't trust news anymore. Whereas really you need to focus the debate on what you can control. And what you can control is what your newsroom looks like and what your news looks like, right? And so what is happening right now is kind of like a survival of the biggest. So lot of the smaller, more local. And when I say local, I mean like the Chicago Tribune. I don't mean like a small, tiny paper, because those two are very straight threatened. But it's like the big papers are more with the biggest audiences, because of the way that digital economics work, are more likely to survive. And those big papers are in places that have traditionally been media capitals, right? Like New York and DC. And it's not just papers, it's like CNN, right? And CNN's kind of interesting, I think, because as you've seen more coverage of Georgia and Atlanta through, right? Usually it's like people forget that CNN is even in Atlanta.
Right.
But with COVID, you've seen how CNN has like owned that Atlanta and Georgia presence. But kind of more to the point around like who gets to be part of these newsrooms. Well, how do you set yourself up to work at one of the elite national newsrooms in this country? Well, you intern there, right? And who can afford to intern? Well, maybe you get lucky because you happen to go to school in New York, and so you're not paying for extra housing to work at like a New York publication, but or a New York outlet. But when you think about like how hard it is to just as a student get to one of these big cities, pay rent for the summer, like, and then maybe not even get paid for your job, right? Like that unpaid internship circuit or poorly paid internship circuit, just by the nature of like just very basic starting out, cuts out huge potentials journalist, right? Just because of the way that that is structured. And I think like we don't like to talk about pipelines because it seems like such a narrow intervention, but you have to think about it as a pipeline, because who gets to have an internship dictates who ultimately gets to run a news organization, right?
Well, yeah. And we're seeing a lot of this too with the New York Times unionization fight. I don't know if you followed that at all. I'm sure you did.
Yeah.
You had big name reporters like Maggie Haberman opposing the unionization fight. And then you have hundreds of people who are working on staff there who probably, a lot of them, as you say, may already have affluent backgrounds because they're in the room. I mean, that's what's difficult about that, is because the majority of people who are in the room are there because they had the advantages to be there. I guess just talk about that particular fight as it fits into your thesis.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that it's really important to note that the New York Times does have journalists that are coming from CUNY and some of the, you know, local schools. And I think that the problem is like, how empowered are those journalists and how much harder is it for them to be heard? And I know that it is harder for journalists who are not coming from Harvard to get heard and noticed. They have to work twice as hard, or sometimes three times as hard, particularly if they're a journalist who is non-white. And so I think like with regard to the unionization fight, it's actually an old fight. And it's a fight that begins with the story of whether digital content is worth as much in terms of labor as sort of content that would run in the print paper, right? And for the longest time, anybody who was like a strictly New York Times digital employee, because of the way that their contract was structured, got paid less, just by the virtue of the fact that their single output was going to be digital first. And obviously, that's become incredibly archaic, right? And you know, the unionization effort itself, I think, reflects larger tensions at the Times, where the Times, on one hand, has a generation of journalists who are like, who do care about social justice, but they also see themselves as like doing fact-based journalism, right? Can those two coexist? Well, for a younger generation of journalists, I absolutely think that that's the case. Those are journalists also who don't have the houses in Montclair yet, right? These are journalists who are struggling. Like, you can have like a backup plan, and you can have, you know that if you miss a month's rent, maybe you can borrow it from your parents, but that's really different than being able to like afford to have a life in New York, right? And
right.
And so I think that that kind of more woke generation of young journalists, one, they don't see any difference between like the what their journalism looks like and what the kind of like ultimate way people first meet it is, right? But also like to some degree, it's just a culture, like a real culture war almost at the times about, and I think if I had to call it, my guess is that when Dean Baquet steps down, that choice of who becomes the editor-in-chief is going to tell you a lot about how much that new generation of voices is going to be listened to. It's a really huge decision.
So one of the things you wrote about too was kind of the effect that was felt in the 2016 election. And just, I mean, some of the issues and the critiques that were laid bare just by the response to that and the things missed, mm-hmm. and also the writing that followed. What were some of the dynamics that you felt Trump's victory exposed in a lot of these papers and larger outlets?
Yeah. And so I should say, just by the way, for like the ethos of being able to speculate on the Times, I did write a whole book on the Times called Making News at the New York Times. So like, it's not totally coming out of nowhere for anybody tuning in. as far as sort of your question about what 2016 showed us, I think it's what 2016 and 2020 showed us, to be quite honest, which is that numbers don't tell the whole story, and you can't get the pulse of a country just by polling it. And you can't get the pulse of a country just by listening to political operatives who are in D.C.
Tell Nate Silver that, please.
I know. Unfortunately, there's a lot of like political communication scholars who don't find Nate Silver to be their best friend right now. But I mean, I start so many of my talks with that 71% Clinton like slide, that slide of her predicting, like Nate Silver's like prediction of 71%, like that Hillary would win, right? And what happens is, for those of us who pay a lot of attention to politics, we think of politics as a game. And I think there's nothing that exemplifies that more than like that New York Times crazy like dial ticker thing.
Oh, yeah,
that whole thing, right? And it's not. It's people on the ground who like have experiences that are not like yours. And if you're coming from New York City, it's really easy to not know what's going on and to judge them for living a life that's different than yours. And I really do feel this, especially now, because I live in central Illinois and I can walk to a cornfield. And like there's so much geographic disconnection, because some of the places that are now referenced as rural America, I've been to, and I know that it's not like that, right? And I know that some of the dynamics they're trying to tease out by these road trips on the Trump safari or like the anti-vax safari, some of those very same dynamics can be playing out right in New York or DC, you know? And so I think one of the biggest problems is treating the rest of the country as a caricature rather than the rest of the country as it actually exists. And that is a massive blind spot that I think requires continual self-examination.
So is part of that solution having hubs throughout the country for more of these major papers?
You know, I think we saw a really important trend happening when people started delisting, like, you need to be in D.C., there are some journalists or New York, right, that this can be located outside of there. And I think what's really interesting, there are some journalists who are trying to cover national politics from Texas, for example. Like, what does it mean to cover national politics outside of the nation's capital, right? So I do think bureaus and hubs are one solution. I also think, look, a lot of these really, really talented local journalists have, like, they don't have the same kind of support they used to have from their news organizations. There's a lot of talent that's locally based that can be scooped up and used to the advantage of these large outlets. And I think you're starting to see some of that. But it's hard to, I mean, a lot of these efforts think that, you know, St. Louis is a small city, and it's not, you know, and I think that's like, you know, or we can cover the South from Atlanta, which just also, right? And so I think it's like about being really strategic about using local talent that's unused, and better connecting to the organizations that are on the ground to really surface those narratives. And unfortunately, big national news outlets don't always think that much of the reporters that are on the ground, because otherwise they would be working for their national news outlet, right?
Well, so then that kind of brings it back to this reinforcing dynamic, self-reinforcing dynamic, where you have people from affluent backgrounds in these newsrooms who don't really see the value in bringing in voices that are more locally based in the areas that they're reporting, and then it creates this gap in coverage. And then after these elections, there's a reckoning. How did we get this wrong? How did we not understand this? And I guess part of this, a lot of people talk about the decline of local news as like one of the bigger reasons, but you had a pretty interesting take on this romanticism of the local newspaper that you wrote about, which is basically a myth in many ways in the way that it's portrayed. Talk about that, because I think that's where maybe some of your critique really does diverge from what a lot of people in the news business are trying to propose as a solution.
So it is true that we are more focused as a nation on national politics and on national news media. And that's where sort of like the attention is, right? But the solution is not to prop up these decaying local newspapers. I mean, I think that it's really important to recognize that even some of the best big metropolitan newspapers in this country have really sordid legacies when it comes to race. I think the LA Times recent series, The Reckoning, where current reporters and, you know, journalists at the Times talk about their own experiences of being discriminated against at the newspaper is a really formidable reminder of how these large institutions, even some of the best of them, remain mostly white institutions that have not, you know, really connected with the communities that they serve. So that's one thing. But when we start talking about like this vision of, oh my gosh, if there aren't local journalists on the ground, there are going to be school boards that go uncovered, and there are going to be sewer boards that go uncovered, and everything's going to be super corrupt now. Well, in a lot of these towns and counties across the United States, the person who runs the school board also runs the local newspaper. And I think like that it's a very misguided, very metropolitan-based understanding of what local news in a community is like, because in many, many regards, that community newspaper, and I'm talking about like a, you know, 30,000 circulation daily, like in the one in this place where I live, that is pro-business conservatism, isn't questioning, like, you know, we had this case where a hospital is full based on actual data, but the PR person comes out and says like, oh no, we're fine. And the paper doesn't question that. So it's not like there's this like huge accountability journalism that has been happening. That's a fantasy for the vast.
It's like a fantasy out of To Kill a Mockingbird.
It is.
Right?
Sorry, you're getting me worked up. But like even The To Kill a Mockingbird, can you imagine? That's like that had to have been a segregationist newspaper, right? Like,
well, right. If you think about it a little too hard, it doesn't. It doesn't really square with the romanticism that a lot of people in media have about their profession, which also translates to elitism and this insular kind of dynamic that you're talking about. I also thought this was such a really a great part of your book, where you talk about how the subscription model for a lot of these newspapers is reinforcing some of these very dynamics, right? Because it's making journalism, quality journalism that's funded, even though with all of the biases that we're talking about, but say like investigative reporting in a way that isn't accessible to a lot of papers. It's making it a private good. And so then it's the rich and white pay for the news, and the rich and white are in the newsrooms. And that's this like kind of pocket. Talk about the ramifications of that.
Yeah. So I think what people who aren't in the news industry don't always realize is just how dire it is to have a digital first outlet or a newspaper, because the digital advertising ecosystem has completely collapsed. And so what that means is you need to rely more on subscribers or members or whatever you want to call them. And so who are the kinds of people that are most likely to subscribe to a news outlet? And we know who those people are. And then when you have to really reorient your strategy as a news organization around not necessarily just, you know, serving advertisers, but really like targeting those people who can and will pay, that changes and distorts coverage that was already distorted. Right. And Jack Schaefer in Politico the other day, he called it subscriber bait. And I think that that's exactly what's happening. And I also don't want to lose sight of the asymmetric polarization in some of this. Right. So that like Republicans and Democrats have very different levels of distrust in the news media. And based on public opinion polling, we know that liberals are just more likely to subscribe to local news. And they do this even if it's not very good. It's like a sense of moral obligation, a sense of civic duty. And so I think that changes the contours too. I think we can have a much larger conversation about like, is the news media liberal, blah, blah, blah. But I think when you think about the subscriber base, there are people who are willing to pay for news. They're most likely white because the institutions are white and have served white audiences, and they're liberal. And that is really concerning to me. It should be concerning to us all.
Yeah, but the dynamic is really interesting too, because they're paying for news that is objective, right? Like, they're on the left for the most part, but they're trying to pay for news and subscribe to news that is fact-based and not as opinionated as, say, the media that people on the right are consuming. And like, isn't that interesting that, you know, there's this whole cohort of kind of more elite liberals that want to pay for subscriptions to these papers that don't like or don't really even want the appearance of their news being tilted in a certain way, and then the right has zero problem with that. Like, I mean, that kind of valley between the two is problematic in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're hitting on one of the most difficult problems to disentangle right now, which is, what is it that really continues to drive the distrust that Republicans have in institutional news media? So I think that like, when you look at news on the left for the left, it's just simply not as large of an ecosystem, right? And the question is, why is that? Is it because liberals are looking for, like what you say, fact-based media? Or is it because the news is itself, you know, following a liberal agenda that liberals then associate with, right? And it's implicit rather than explicit. I think that, you know, one of the tensions is that many liberals do want their journalism to do more. And I think that that's why you see whenever the New York Times is overly neutral, right, that a whole host of liberals will say cancel NYT. So I think I would maybe trouble that premise a little bit that, you know, they want fact-based news. Yes, they want reality-based news. That's different, right?
I was more characterizing it in terms of like their perception of what they're paying for.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a really good question, right? Because I don't know if we know, right? I think their perception is that they're paying for reality-based news, and their expectations may be that they want to see it straight. But when that seeing it straight doesn't square with a larger agenda of social justice, I think that's where you see the fissures start to happen, right? And I think you see this particularly around issues of race and the way that these big institutions are covering race.
Well, so how you also talk about the response to Black Lives Matter by some of these institutions. Can you talk about what you found there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're seeing now in journalism is one of the most existential debates that we can see, which is this debate over whether objectivity makes sense at all. And what does it mean to be objective, and where does that stance of objectivity come from? And one of the things that we saw with Black Lives Matter was that Black journalists were saying, like, I can't be objective. This is my livelihood. Like, this is my life. This is my son's life. This is like, how am I supposed to be distanced from this, right? And then you saw more journalists with COVID even, right? Like, how am I distanced from COVID when this is something I'm seeing and living in my own community? And so how do you really reasonably detach an experience of struggle from the experience of trying to cover that, quote, factually? What does that mean? And I think that in the early sort of post-George Floyd moment that we saw, there were some pretty big missteps. I think that the Philadelphia Inquirer published a column header that said, "All buildings matter," with like nice art. And it's like, all buildings matter. How did that happen?
Oh, Philadelphia, no.
Like, how did that happen, right? Like, first of all, Philadelphia as a city is still is majority Black at this point. So like, what happened in the newsroom that nobody caught that like all buildings matter too is like a problem, right? And it ended up being a big issue, and the executive editor ended up leaving. The Times published the Tom Cotton op-ed where it called for, you know, troops to move into the cities to control Black Lives Matter protests. And like, what was really unusual about that is New York Times journalists actually spoke out about how that wasn't okay. That was not an okay decision of the Times. And usually dissent at the Times is very muted, right? You don't see it. And so those moments where it breaks out are particularly noteworthy. But news organizations are, you know, the adaptation we saw was the AP deciding to capitalize B in Black and giving better guidance on how do you define a racist? Do you have to know they're purely racist in their heart to call somebody a racist? And the answer is now no. So those are the kinds of changes we see in an institutional journalism response. But the institutions themselves, I think, are not meaningfully responding not only to the world around them, but to their own journalists.
Right. And a lot of what I see is not necessarily imbued with any class-based analysis, unfortunately. Like, I feel like, yeah, the capital of B, and then we're not really talking more seriously about kind of the institutions that are given credibility or given weight in terms of what's determined to be like an objective fact set for this story, where like it's built on a house of cards, this objective story, because the police that are reporting, giving you these objective facts for your article, that's not objective. The statistics that you're using for this might be skewed in a certain direction. That's not necessarily objective. Like, there's so many layers to what's being reported on that have a faulty foundation that I still feel like is not necessarily being explored.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think the cases that we see at most are taking the word for granted with the military and taking the word for granted. So like with like the military industrial complex with like police and military, I think you see this hardcore. And I think that like part of it is, you know, I think it's a badass factor, like especially with the military. It's like, whoa, these dudes like have gone in and like done some serious, you know, like fighting, and like these are big weapons, so they must know what they're talking about, like deference to authority. That's why we need more veterans in newsrooms, actually, I think. But also with police, it's like that is the thing that you are taught in journalism school or at a journalism internship, is like, you want to know a crowd estimate at a protest, ask the police. But if that protest is a Black Lives Matter protest over police involved murder / shooting, like, what's their incentive to give you an actual count, even if they are good at giving crowd counts, right? And so I think, again, we're seeing some responses. And I think one of the most interesting is the pushback on mugshots, because mugshots are like people at their very worst moment, and being arrested doesn't mean you're guilty. And who gets arrested more than other people? People of color, people who are low income. And so you catch somebody at their worst moment, and then you put their photo up as a slideshow gallery to get clicks, and they lose their kids. Right. And you're starting to see some news organizations recognize that. So at least there are bones. There are bones here, Emma.
Yes. Well, I mean, and hopefully that those bones are a bit of a stronger foundation than the one I just described. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whatever's built going forward. But Dr. Nikki Usher. Her book is called News for the Rich, White and Blue. I really appreciate your time today, Nikki. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to wrap things up. So I thought that that was fascinating and good for, I'm glad we were able to get Nikki to join us. Because I think given last week's news with Afghanistan, particularly with what we've seen over the past few decades about how sources are, especially when it comes to Langley sources or government sources, are used for specific purposes and can't necessarily be trusted. And so, like, you know, this isn't just to say all of, you know, fake news or whatever. There's still, we go to the Washington Post and New York Times for news of the day on the regular, but there's just substantive differences between sourcing on different stories and what you can trust, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I also think it's weird, for instance, to get Afghanistan news from Mika Brzezinski and John McCain's daughter. But
well, apparently some people find value in that, according to the ratings. But
that's our American media, folks.
All right, we have to say goodbye to our Peacock audience. We will see you tomorrow. Whoa.
I mean, if Meghan McCain is objectionable...
Well, threw that right in at the end. All right, folks, thank you for bearing with us. We're glad we were able to get Nick. He just had a miscommunication in terms of the time, but everyone should check out that book. We are going to go into the fun half, do some more clips, take some calls, have a grand old time, maybe crack open a beer. Probably not. But Matt and I were saying...
Maybe on Friday.
Matt and I were saying we're going to do that on Friday, actually.
Somebody sent us a box of... I thought it was HelloFresh.
Well, it was in a HelloFresh box, and...
Which is not what you want to get on a Friday when Sam's not here, because it's like, oh, no. I mean, there's what old, like... I don't know.
Rotting food in there.
Quesadilla ingredients in there.
Not that the food would inherently be rotting, but we just didn't know how long.
But I didn't want to have to carry it across Brooklyn. It's not my food. I wasn't prepared for like a random HelloFresh box.
Right. So we were going to distribute it in another way, but I opened the box after everyone left. What's in the box? And it was not Gwyneth Paltrow's head. It was a lot of beer. So thank you for...
Which is a lot easier to deal with.
Yes, so we stuck that in the fridge, figured that maybe to celebrate my final day of the long hosting gig, we'll crack open a beer on Friday. But anyway, we're going to head into the fun half. What's happening on Left Reckoning this week, though, Matt?
Yesterday, we had a really good interview. I can't figure out patron stuff for Left Reckoning because we do so much stuff, and then I'm like, I can't keep this behind a paywall. But for now, it's behind a paywall. Emma Kinema, she's a lead organizer for Game Workers United and also Communication Workers of America's campaign to organize digital employees. We talked about the Activism Blizzard lawsuit and the frat boy culture and sort of like just harassment endemic to video games industry and why unions and not boycotts are the solution. We always hear about like boycott this, boycott that. And of course, in terms of BDS, obviously there's a clear model of that working. But when it comes to things like consumer products, like video games, the knee-jerk reaction shouldn't be to boycott a game. Even if the employees are being sort of abused, which they often are, that's not the solution. You need to just empower those employees with the union. So we talked to Emma yesterday about that. People should check that out at patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Check out the Noma Key Show. And, of course, I like the stream, Poggers, Hype Train.
Oh, also, go subscribe to Left Reckoning's YouTube channel, because you're already on YouTube. Just go do that.
Right. New tab. Don't close out of this show. God forbid.
No, or at least come back, right back, you know.
Yeah.
I expect you can find your way back.
Yeah. I would hope. I would hope. All right, guys. 646-257-3920. See you in the phone.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.